What's this?
Maybe you remember the project I had with the infinite number of monkeys and the infinite number of typewriters trying to type the works of Shakespeare?
Yes.
Well, the monkey chow bill was killing me, and I eventually figured, you know, what's the point? If they do it, they're just producing work that's in the public domain and that Ira Glass doesn't even like, so I just got rid of all of them.
There's still one here.
Yeah, he won't leave. He thinks he's really onto something. It could be the next 50 Shades of Grey, he says. Okay, let's see what you've got this time. Now, said Baron von Cruelheart, it's time to spank the monkey. He put me over his well-muscled thigh and raised his hand. Incredible release in me. I've been a very naughty monkey. Found my inner goddess. Baby oil, sweatpants, never felt so desired. This is good. I didn't think a monkey could write this well. You're sure this is all original, not plagiarized? Okay, I'm just going to ask you to sign this paper. It waives your copyright and makes clear that this work is for hire, which I own. Fine, have your lawyer call me. Ross Garber? He's pretty good. All the same, buzz off.
You could have handled that better.
Don't tell me my business. I provided the monkey house, the monkey chow, the monkey bed, the monkey vitamin water, the monkey iPod loaded with songs by the monkeys. And what does he do? Write a couple of pages of hot porn for housewives, and I have to hand him the keys to my BMW? I'll see his little hairy butt in court. Today on the nose, the movie Boyhood, the war over spanking, and yes, the copyright battle over a monkey selfie. And now, the movie about his boyhood was shut down when the Spanish-American War broke out. Colin McEnroe.
I don't even want to talk about that. It dashed a lot of dreams I had. Yes, welcome to the news. Special Ape Not Instagram Ape Edition. We'll be talking about Richard Linklater's precedent-breaking movie Boyhood, in which he used 12 years to shoot the fictional story of a young man coming of age, and then move on to those other topics later. Let me introduce our panel. Mark Oppenheimer's Boyhood would have been the stuff of movies if he had spent less time as a debate nerd, as chronicled in his book Weisenheimer, and more time speculating about the meaning of life. He writes a biweekly beliefs column for the New York Times, also reports for The Atlantic, The Nation, This American Life, and this summer he is guest editing because of maternity leave. He is the guest editor of Tablet, the online Jewish publication. Certainly jump online and read his fabulous work, or at least send him an angry email without having read anything. Speaking of maternity leave, Tracy Wu Fastenberg is returning to the news after a lengthy maternity leave and broken ankle, better known as the movie National Lampoon's Summer Lactation. She has sold the film rights to her baby to Clint Eastwood. She works at the Mark Twain House of Pancakes. Almost everything can be improved by the addition of pancakes. Movies about James Hanley's boyhood very quickly come to resemble The Pelican Brief as he is pursued through a series of dimly lit parking garages by international oligarchs who know he will grow up to be a threat to their ruthless agendas. He runs Trinity Cine Studio. So that's our panel today. We are going to begin with the movie Boyhood, which we've all seen. Richard Linklater, the director, was never a stickler for plot. A lot of his movies, especially the Before Sunrise trilogy with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, are mainly people talking. His newest film, Boyhood, is a lot of that, but also a lot more. People who like this movie really like it. America's greatest living film critic David Edelstein wrote this: "I'm not saying Boyhood is the greatest film I've ever seen, but I'm thinking there's my life before I saw it and my life now, and it's different. I know movies can do something that just last week I didn't. They can make time visible." So I'm curious to know what our panel thought. Oppie, why don't you get us started? Pick a vector, and
sure,
we'll follow you.
I'm a huge Linklater fan, though not the Before Sunrise, Sunset, whatever those are, which I find not very gripping. But Dazed and Confused was a really, really, really important movie for me. Though the first time I saw it, I didn't remember it. I was in college, and I'd had a lot to drink before I went.
And you were dazed and confused.
But it wasn't that. It was that this is a somewhat embarrassing story. I had to go to the bathroom so many times during it. And I was on a date.
That's the nerd version of dazed and confused.
Right. I was on a date with a very, 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 very beautiful woman, and I was very excited for it. And I said, let's go to the Med School Film Society. This was at Yale. And they had, you know, prints of these new movies right around the time they were released. And I just had to get up and go to the bathroom so many times that I thought there was a plot that I was just missing. And it wasn't until I saw it on video a couple years later that I realized, no, I hadn't actually missed a plot. But I've become a huge devotee of that movie. And I'm not the kind of person who says that I'm a devotee. You know, I don't talk that way about myself. But I love that movie very, very much. I loved School of Rock, which of course did have a plot. I think Linklater is a very, very fine filmmaker. I expected this movie because – I expected Boyhood because I'm a compulsively nostalgic person who tends to get weepy at anything that reminds me of the week before last to destroy me. It didn't destroy me. I thought it was really, 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 really good. And I thought it was, you know, a kind of breathtakingly original thing to do and the kind of thing where you think, how did no one ever do this before? That said, I'm surprised by Edelstein's reaction to it. I like his criticism as well, and it didn't do that to me in the way that it did that to him. So I'd be curious to hear from people who were destroyed by it like that.
All right. If you were destroyed by it or not just destroyed by it, you may call us at 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Just to make sure we're setting the scene properly, this is a movie. It is about the life of a boy named Mason. It takes him across roughly, I think, a 12-year arc, which is how long Linklater spent making the movie. In other words, he allotted 12 years, and as everybody, including him, dove in and out of other projects, he would come back to this movie and shoot another phase of it. So you roughly see, I think, from about the age of 7 to about the age of 19, I'm guessing, the story of this boy, Mason, as he goes through a series of schools. His mother goes through a series of marriages. His father appears magically now and again to do very entertaining and sustaining things, but doesn't do the nitty-gritty day-to-day work of bringing him up. And towards the end, we see him heading off to college and a whole series of other adventures. So, Tracy Wu Fastenberg, I'm just sort of going around the horn first and just sort of seeing. I mean, did this movie work for you? What did work or didn't work for you?
I liked the concept of it. So going into it, when you said, hey, we're going to go see Boyhood, I'm like, that's the only movie this summer that I'm actually interested in seeing, because it was such a different way to approach it with the same actor every year for 12 years where you can see him growing up. And I loved the idea of it. I still haven't decided if I actually liked the movie. And I didn't dislike it, but it didn't slay me. It didn't really move me to a whole other level. And about 2 hours in, I thought it was over. And for the next 45, 50 minutes, I kept on sort of hoping it was over. It just seemed very lengthy. The dialogue wasn't as scintillating as I wanted it to be, but it also wasn't so natural that you kind of got lost in it and felt like you were just eavesdropping on somebody's conversation, because there was some stiltingness to it that wasn't quite natural. So I don't know. I'm sort of an 80% right now at liking it.
All right, which is well below its Rotten Tomatoes score. Its Rotten Tomatoes score is 99% favorable critical reception, which you don't see that often. All right, James, you have the floor.
Well, I have to say I was completely absorbed by the film, even its full 160-minute length. One of the things that fascinates me about Richard Linklater is that he is a person who's seems to have had a very satisfying sort of intellectual life, making films, writing films, engaging on what seems like an impossible project, taking 12 years to make a film, with a plan to a certain extent, but also taking an enormous risk that the participants would actually be willing to continue. His own daughter, I think, at some point.
She was probably a safer bet, right? I
mean, well, no, she wasn't.
She actually said she wanted to be killed off so that she wouldn't be in it. But then she changed her mind. But what is fascinating
there?
She plays
the big sister of the boy.
That's right. And I think that she's actually a very pivotal character. I mean, I think that she really is important in terms of her contrast in character development. But again, the thing that Richard Linklater brings is a sort of complete insouciance about the market. And there's no marketing been in this film, really. And I was struck by the thing that at the end of the movie, you always sit through the credits. And as I was sitting through the credits, I was looking for the I knew how the film was made, that it was it was following the same person. But I was looking for the different characters being played at different ages. Mm. And then I suddenly thought, wait a minute, what am I looking for that for? And it sort of reminded me of how this film crosses the boundaries. And it almost has a sort of a documentary quality, but it completely lifts out of that with a conceptual sense of development and how crises affect people differently, how people, some people sort of cruise along and then they fall apart. Some, there are clues to characters that appear. Since it's real people over 12 years, the clues have real significance because you get to see what did those clues mean 4, 5, 6, 8 years on.
Yeah, I think it was Manola Dargis in The Times said she watched it 3 times. And I want to go back and watch it again. I, too, was very, very absorbed. Again, it didn't slay me, but I was very absorbed. There was something I loved about it, internal to it, and something I loved about the process. Internally, I want to say Linklater's very good on that slice of America that is working class or just a little bit above.
Yeah.
The mom in this, you know, she finishes college, then she seems to get a master's, then she seems to be some sort of adjunct, and they're still poor, which, of course, is entirely possible in the world of American academia. The husbands come and go, and the kid eventually gets off to state university, which is going to be his salvation. And that's a really interesting thing to say in a movie, which is, hey, if you sort of hang in there and keep doing your work, and maybe you can aspire to go to state U. I mean, and that's not a slice of American life that gets enough attention.
And of course, it's
completely normative for tens of millions of people. The other thing I would say is the process, you know, it was like 2 or 3 days a summer for 12 summers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a reminder to those of us who do creative work, like a little bit at a time really does add up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people did incredible work in this movie. You sort of wonder maybe actors would be better in general, you know, if you use them that way instead of the way that we use them. Well, I've got a whole bunch of things that I want to talk about. One of them, the first one I wanted to talk about was the title. Initially, it seems as though the title does apply solely to this character played by L.R. Coltrane. He's Mason. He's the boy we're watching growing up. But the more I watched this movie, I thought, no, it's really kind of about all the men in this movie, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It absolutely is about all the men and about sort of male issues and how men figure out their role. So Ethan Hawke does play this kind of wandering father who's in and out of his kids' lives. But I mean, basically seemed like a very nice and appealing person. But ends up
selling insurance of all things, right?
And in that sort of classic post-divorce divide, you know, he's just not doing the daily work. He shows up, you know, for the bowling trip, the camping trip, all of this kind of stuff. But, you know, even like these little characters, like his brother who we see for, you know, 2 minutes at a graduation party, also expressing – I mean the portrait of maleness – was not an entirely flattering one, but I think he kind of lays out a lot of interesting men's issues there. And who wants to take that one away from me?
Well, I think that that's a really important aspect of the movie because the issue, what you're really focused on is L.R. Coltrane, Mason, as he is developing and what he's reading from all these characters around him, like a failed stepfather, for example, and you know, the telegraphing of what that means and why he's failing and why other men seem to be failing. And one of the curious paradoxes is Ethan Hawke's character, his father, is really in many ways he succeeds in spite of himself. Mm. And he is a person who really seems to maintain a hold in Mason's life. But I don't want to spoil the story, but there's a point at which he actually fails at that quite obviously. And it's an interesting statement about how what you expect about people and what you expect about people you look up to, sometimes you can be surprised about that. And in a way, I think that that actual moment makes Mason a more believable character because he's actually becoming aware of flaws in a way that he had taken very personally. And then he comes out of that and develops out of that. And again, that seems to me to be part of the process of making a film over such a long time that you can really ponder these things and how these characters will come out. And Richard Linklater is a sort of person who does kind of ramble at times, you know, like the Before Sunrise type of thing that is a lot of talk. I actually found those interesting. But the issue is sometimes if you're getting that all together and the whole film is that, it sometimes obscures the character development that would actually inform that discussion. And that's what happens in Boyhood, I think, is that you get both. And that's why, to me, it's so absorbing and interesting.
I thought a lot about men's responsibilities and how they sort of approach it. You know, that first boyfriend that the mother has, it's like, well, my friends are expecting me. Like, that's my responsibility, not to stay here with you and your kids. Yeah. And then as you go through kind of the different men that she's with, the professor who happened to be an alcoholic, you know, he saw it that he provided for everyone, but they owed him. They owed him respect. Yeah. They owed him whatever it was that, you know, ticked him off over time, obedience and doing chores and stuff. And then the veteran that she married later on was very bitter about the fact that he was supposed to provide for these kids that weren't his, that, you know, didn't pay attention to him and come home on curfew. And then his father, who saw his responsibility as more being there, you know, he understood what they should have been in sort of a materialistic aspect of, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not here. He tried to make up for it. He pulled over to the side of the road and said, we need to have real conversations. We need to have a relationship. He just didn't know how quite to get there. But I think he understood more of what a child needs than some of these other men. And so I thought it was a nice kind of dichotomy as you went through them all.
If you saw Boyhood and you want to join this conversation, again, 860-275-7266. Or if you just refuse to see 2 hours and 45 minutes worth of movies in which – a movie in which really not that many major plot points occur. Although we could debate that, though. You may tweet us also at WNPR Colin.
Who was the James, are there other examples you can think of director-actor collaborations as sustained as Ethan Hawke and Richard Linklater? I mean, he's used him in at least 4 movies, yeah. And I love that he keeps using him. Ethan Hawke's not my favorite actor, but I think he gets good performance out of him, and I think in this movie, that was the character that actually almost brought me to tears because the to see him kind of gradually accept that life is not about driving a fast car and having fun and that he has to start wearing Dockers and and provide was very heartbreaking.
The other thing that's really uncanny, and Rand Cooper was with me last night when I saw the movie, is, and he pointed it out, was that, you know, we watch everybody age for real. In other words, we're watching everybody sort of get older.
Right.
And it's noticeable on everybody. Except that for the first, like, 8 or 9 of the 12 years, Ethan Hawke does not age at all.
Exactly the same.
Yeah. In real life, Ethan Hawke just wasn't getting older. And then there's, like, a little kind of Dorian Gray spurt at the end.
I wonder if they sort of grade up his temples at the end to make that point. Ethan Hawke's... He's a pretty youthful-looking guy. But, I mean, what about that collaboration?
Well, I think that really is unusual. And I think that Ethan Hawke is an unusual actor in that I think a lot of actors presented with that possibility would probably see their careers at a different point. Like, you know, 6 years down the line, an actor may have see his career having crossed to some different kind of appearance or different kind of film that he's making. Ethan Hawke seems to be – I mean, that was the uncanny thing about this film all the way through, that sort of almost documentary quality. It's crossing that barrier where the character could actually be a fictional character in a movie who's developing, who actually comes across in a way that is documentarian about what is going on. And I think that he is a person who – he just seems to be unpretentious, I think, which is why I like him as an actor, because he is able to do this and not see it as somehow about him. Because the character – he becomes that character and he takes that time to actually develop through the film. And he's still – at the end of the movie, he's not – some sort of, you know, like stereotype. He's really gone through all sorts of changes. And in a way, L.R. Coltrane is following the same trajectory in a different time of his life, and he's coming out at the end of it. There's a sort of – the expression on his face at the end, just before the fade-out, said that to me about that. And I thought that's something that Richard Linklater somehow – divines really exactly right.
I want to make sure we also talk about women in this movie, and particularly about Patricia Arquette, who's getting rave notices for her performance. It's a different kind of experience than watching Ethan Hawke. You really do see her age. You see all kinds of things happen. This would have been shot probably between her ages of 33 and 46. It included, I think, some pregnancies and maybe not immediately losing the weight from those pregnancies. So you see her body change in lots of different ways too. But at least one writer that I saw said you could just as easily have called this movie Motherhood. It really is, at times anyway, her story. And it's a really – I mean, I don't know. I'm looking over at you as our designated woman here. But to me, it's a really wrenching portrait of a woman too, a woman who is trying to do that work as a single mom and making a lot of really bad decisions but also doing some pretty marvelous things with herself. I don't know. How did that character play for you?
I was actually surprised by it, how much I liked her, even though at certain times it seemed like she was sort of disengaged by, you know, hooking up with these gentlemen who were really not the best for her, not the best for her children, and not seeing it right away. But I think that that's very natural. I think that, you know, probably for men in bad relationships with women too. You know, you just don't see that reality until a certain point. But she does all the things that she thinks is right for her family, for her children throughout it. And I think one of the saddest points is sort of when he's heading off to school and she's like, and here I am, you know, I dedicated my life to all this stuff. And she felt like she didn't have a whole lot to show for it. And I sort of wonder if that's a little commentary on some of the women who want it all.
I'd read that line differently. When she sort of starts sobbing, he's about to go off to college the next day or the next week, and she says, you know, I thought there'd be more. And I think it's that she feels what inevitably people feel when their kids leave, which is, wait, where did it go? I think it was about just her boy's about to go off to college and her daughter's already there, and then she's going to be in her little apartment and she's single again and she has her adjunct course load and what else. But I think it was just that I can't believe my boy's leaving, which was terrific.
I think that she's a very interesting character in that way, because actually, although she's picking up these different men that she feels need to be a father to her kids, and they turn out to be not necessarily such good fathers, I think that one of the things is that she, meanwhile, all of that is going on, she becomes the most loyal parent, as it were, almost taking on the father and the mother role, mm-hmm. that she really is making that her life. And then toward the end, when he's leaving to go to college, I think it almost, in the context of the film, it almost comes across as a sort of momentary thing about, was this the right thing, almost? Like I completely sort of mortgaged my life, really, to what I felt I needed to do, and then they're leaving, kind of thing. And she's losing sight of the fact that she's actually got two pretty, like, secure kids who are coming out of it. But isn't that a sort of natural reaction you have when you've put all of that energy?
That's what parenthood is. That,
yeah, exactly.
They leave and
yeah.
you have, you know, what you have to show for it is that they don't need you anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I also saw this as, and I'm not a Linklater guy, and I kind of avoided those after Sunset before. I mean, I just, you know, I'm not a Linklater guy. But I haven't said it yet. I was absolutely mesmerized by this movie. The 2 hours and 45 minutes flew by for me. I didn't need it to end any sooner. I feel it is the movie I would compare it to in some ways is Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. But this is a much more accessible, approachable movie. It's not going to scare people away the way that movie did, as good as that movie is. But one of the things that I marvel at is Linklater's absolute fastidious avoidance of big moments, you know, the kinds yeah. of big moments we are now almost Pavlovianly conditioned to expect, right? You know, watching these movies. Now, I'm watching this movie and there's a car driving down the highway and I think, well, they're going to have a car accident, you know. Or
I thought someone was going to end up gay.
Yeah. So, well, I did think Ethan Hawke was gay for a while. Yeah,
did you?
I did, yeah.
I thought the son was going to have – I thought Mason was going to have a gay experience.
But, you know, you keep waiting for these big reveals or a kind of a moment of violence. There's a guy breaking board, you think, well, somebody's going to wind up in intensive care or something. Right. That doesn't happen, and it's the movie is spellbinding nonetheless. And I do think that sometimes the things that are jarring about this have less to do with what Linklater's doing and more to do with what we are conditioned to expect yeah. will happen in a movie.
Exactly.
And so even that last scene we're talking about, or penultimate scene where Patricia Arquette, as she's saying goodbye to her son, just kind of dissolves into this moment of self-pitying bitterness. I think initially I thought, well, this just plays wrong with me. It's not really working. And then I'm thinking, no, I'm just very conditioned to expect that scene where the son goes off to college is going to be played in a different way. And he's just not going to do that. He's not giving me all the things that I'm used to consuming, like pap. You know, I mean, and I admire this movie so much, but I don't think the movie is a chore at all. I'm almost hard pressed to say why it's so incredibly engrossing, but I found it. I just was hanging on every moment of it.
Yeah, I should say that although it didn't, it was at 90% for me, Tracy. But I really want to see it again. I mean, and I don't want to see anything again. I'm not the kind of person who rewatches stuff. I don't reread books. Like mm-hmm. to want to see it again was really. Mm-hmm. Big for me, and but I am a Linklater guy, so it's not as big as it is for Colin, who has described himself as not a Linklater guy.
Not a Linklater guy. I mean, I'm aware of the fact that, to use Rand's phrase from last night, occasionally he's quoting his own movies. You know, there's sort of a scene where I think they're on top of a parking garage or something in Austin, looking at the sunrise, and you're thinking, well, yeah, okay, we saw that movie.
Well, there's okay. a great Say Anything yeah. reference when they're all hanging out with the older boys, and then one of them says, well, like, if you're so cool and know so much about women, why are you hanging out with us?
Right.
Yes.
And that's directly
yes.
from behind the gas and sip and yeah. Say Anything, which
yeah.
made my night.
Right. Very very quickly before we run out of time, I think we do have to say one more thing maybe, or I'd love to hear you guys a little bit, just on the way, I mean, time really is a character in this movie, or it's the ultimate special effect. That's what I find myself thinking, that, you know, you're watching these things, and as James says, another thing we're conditioned to do is to say, oh, yeah, who plays the young Mason? Or no, it's like always the same person. And they're, you know, and he doesn't call attention to it. Sometimes you have to watch a little bit carefully. You notice, oh, wait a minute, the haircut's a little bit different, or somebody's driving a different car. You suddenly realize we've gone ahead one more year. But it's not like these big slides are coming across the screen saying 2 years later. But what's happening, though, is you watch time writing on all of their faces and their bodies, and especially this boy. You know, this they didn't have to do anything, any, you know, makeup or anything like that. Just the way time writes on this kid, it is fascinating to watch. It is as dramatic an upheaval just watching stuff happen in the normal course of time as anything I could think of.
I think that that's something that is very special to Linklater in this case, being very successful at that, because so many films that look at things happening over time, I mean, it can range from things like having voiceovers or title slugs that say, you know, the time has passed, or otherwise very dramatic remake-ups of somebody or somebody else playing the part. And one of the things, touching on what you said, Colin, about expectations, I think the film is full of almost sort of like games that Linklater is playing by sort of leading you to a place where you think you know what the transition is, or you think that, you know, this idea that maybe the car is going to crash or something, is playing with the notion of the way many movies are made, which are punctuated by dramatic events that turn the narrative one way or another. And it's focusing you back on the whole idea of actually paying attention to these details and paying attention to one of the other fascinating things is how Patricia Arquette changes her reaction to the husband, the college professor who's drinking. Her subtle reaction there, you have to pay attention to the expressions and the things she's doing in the house and stuff like that. And I love to sort of tease that apart. And I think it is a film that yields to seeing more than once, absolutely, so that you can sort of see how those things went together. And maybe it is a function of the length of the time that he was working on it, but also a good writer who's thinking. I mean, he's obviously had it in his head the whole 12 years.
All right. It's Boyhood. It's playing at major motion picture houses, multiverses, whatever they're called, and some smaller places as well. I'm sure it will come to Trinity Cine Studio, and then you can watch it four nights in a row on very good equipment and on a very big screen. But if you can't wait, see it now. It got an 80 from Tracy Wu Fastenberg and 90 from Mark Oppenheimer. I think James and I are both pretty close to 99% on this one. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about spanking. We're going to talk about monkeys. We're not going to talk about the two of them together, though, after this.
We're all here, the children are waiting. We're all here, and time is a wasting just like it should, just like my boyhood. We're all here.
So, when we do the news, what we do is we send emails back and forth, and it all gets very complicated and convoluted. You have to make sure you read all the emails. And sometimes I'm not even sure where certain topics kind of come in, but then they're sort of – they've been on 8 emails in a row, and they sort of become topics. So we had a whole bunch of ideas this week about what we would talk about. Somehow or other, spanking – I think actually Kyan Wolf started this, but I could be wrong. Somehow or other, we got spanking on our email. And I think it probably stems from a couple of different things. Corporal punishment has been kind of in the news lately, partly because of a New York court ruling that decided that a father had not abused his son by spanking him. This also has sort of occasioned a lot of writing about spanking and bringing forth of some of the scientific evidence about spanking, some of which suggests that it either doesn't work very well or might even be in odd ways dangerous for your child. But it also kind of touched off this kind of, I don't know, culture war on Christmas thing. The National Review was basically saying that just if there's been a war on Christmas, there's also been a war on spanking, and that liberals don't like it, and it's banned in places like Sweden and Delaware, which are basically probably the same place. And
Delaware has more banks.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, it would be a close race as to who has more banks. So On the other hand, according to the National Review, roughly 80% of parents admit to hitting their children, but that they may not be far off, they write breathlessly, when giving a child a quick slap on the rear for misbehavior will get a parent labeled a child abuser. So anyway, it's all in front of us. We don't really have time for a lengthy conversation about spanking, but we'll start it off with the tiger mom-to-be, Tracy Wu Fastenberg. That tiny little baby I know has not been spanked yet. But
not even a little, so. Yeah. Just lots of kisses. When Kevin brought that up, it actually made me really think, because it's something that my husband and I have talked about. But one of the things that Kion had said in her email was, you know, when it came down to it, if my child was being, you know, really horrific, you know, I haven't made that decision yet. And so it kind of brought me to the place of, well, you know, what would be my recourse if suddenly Claire decided that she was being awful, you know, when she hits a certain age and size? And I still have to sit there and say, no, there's absolutely not a chance that I would raise a hand to my child, no matter, even if she was bigger than I was. You know, the CNN article, I think it was CNN, indicated that there's a lack of gray matter. There's less gray matter in children who are struck. And I think that they were talking specifically more about paddles and belts, which I was horrified to think that anybody's still using that. You know, whether it's a parent's right to spank their child, I can't make that decision for them, so I guess everybody has their own right. But for me personally, it's just not an option.
Well, now, Mark Oppenheimer has lots and lots of children, and there's some kind of Spanish word that he gave us for a man. One of the things that made him an interesting guest on the subject of boyhood is that he has only daughters. What is the Spanish word for the man?
A chancletero, which is a slipper man, a slipperisto, a man in slippers, is a Caribbean and Venezuelan, Colombian, that region of the Caribbean Spanish slang for a man who has only daughters.
Yeah, so you have only daughters.
Only daughters, four of them. Haven't hit them yet. Long-time listener, first time. So, you know, we'll see. Have you back in a year or two. The eldest is seven. Look, here's the thing about corporal punishment. I'm less interested in judging the person who has spanked a child, or even on great occasion, than I am in thinking about what it does to the parent, which is that it coarsens you. And I don't want to be the kind of person who uses violence. And I think the more you use it, the easier it gets to use it, just like the more you go to war, the easier it gets to go to war the next time. And you don't want to be in a household where there are people who are giving in to their violent tendencies, except the really little people who don't have that great self-control. So that's sort of the way I feel about it. I've had a friend argue back before in college. I had an argument with someone who's like, yeah, but if my parents hit me, and if they hadn't, I would have turned out a delinquent or something. And I think that among parents who hit, they actually sort of believe their kids turn out better than kids who aren't hit. They actually have a claim they're making, which is hitting is regrettable, but look at all the bad people in the world. They weren't beaten enough as kids. And I just think there's no reason to believe that.
I think exactly the reverse is true, actually.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. I
think that the issue really is power and unfair power. And if you're hitting a child as an adult, it's a totally untenable lesson that you're teaching to a child about the superior power, and then adding physical pain to it, physical power. I think it's just totally, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. That's an unfair exploitation. I mean, maybe spanking for, you know, bank CEOs and, you know, public TV shows with it.
I think that'd be great.
I think there we were onto something.
And we've managed to have this conversation so far without mentioning Daphne Merkin. But I'll tell a quick story here because having been on the radio.
Because it's your show,
it's my show. And, no, this is a story that does not reflect entirely well on me, but my life is an open book at this point. There's no hope. So I helped raise a young boy who was quite frequently, I think by his own admission today, he would tell you he was rebellious, whatever he could possibly think of something to rebel against, and sometimes even when he couldn't. But I was sort of determined not to spank him, not to raise my hand against him, not to strike him, and I managed never to do that, but it was very difficult, and there were lots of times when I wanted to. And so I substituted this other thing that we came to call, and there was a term for it in the house, and it was called alpha wolfing. And what I would do was I would put him on his back, and then I would press down on his – hold him down, pressing down on his chest, and I would get my face very close to him, and sometimes I would growl at him. And so
– Were you in costume?
Yeah. So – and one of the difficulties of having any kind of innovative parenting strategy like that one, whether it works or not, is that your son will talk about it in school eventually, because he also he doesn't know also that it's completely unique to his household.
Right.
So he'll be talking in class and he'll say, well, yeah, but I was Alpha Wolfed for that. and then the teachers and the other students will say, you were what? And he goes, I was Alpha Wolfed. And then he'll have to explain what Alpha Wolfing is. And
that's
obviously
like the Friends episode where it turns out that Monica and Ross have a special family symbol for giving the finger. And to them it means, you know, it's right. equivalent, yeah. it's co-equal, but only in their family did they do that gesture rather than, you know.
But I sort of wondered, I mean, I was, once we sort of got onto this and I read some more stuff about it, and there's clinical literature that suggests, among other things, that spanking doesn't work, that they've really even studied situations where children are spanked for a specific kind of behavior. They return to that behavior after 10 minutes.
Right.
So it apparently doesn't even sort of get the message across. But I was sort of both surprised and unsurprised to be immediately able to find a national publication like the National Review that was seeing this, and there's more evidence of this, as essentially a political issue. Like, you sort of think about all the things that can be politicized, which I guess turns out to be everything.
I think that's a function of some sort of new software we haven't learned about yet that is detecting issues, you know, detecting partisan issues, the ability to actually sort of they check it every morning at
it's
the National Review.
It's an app. It's an app.
An app, right? They have it. Yeah, it's an app now. So you can just check and see, does spanking have potential to be partisan? And so if it does, if it says yes, you go with it.
There's the spine of a reasonable political argument there, which is that, you know, the less the state is in your household, the better, which I think is something that people on the left feel about sexual freedoms, but people on the right feel it about hitting kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're both right, actually. I mean, I really, you know, I don't actually want the state superintending my disciplinary procedures except in the most egregious circumstances. So
imagine what I would have gotten for Alpha Wolfing.
Alpha, I mean, that's
how do you categorize that?
Yeah, by the way, it sounds like a strange practice.
It's kind of Appalachian.
Watch out, you're in the National Review app already, Colin.
Right. And this is a Pandora's box that I don't necessarily want to open right now, but there is. There's also sort of a whole cultural component to this, right? I mean, in fact, there's a classic and I have to say very funny comedy routine which you can find on YouTube by a guy named, I think, Russell Peters. He's Canadian and he's Indian, East Indian American, or East Indian Canadian or something anyway. And it's usually called White People, You've Got to Start Hitting Your Kids. And it's all about how white people don't hit their kids, but, you know, people from his culture do. And I don't really know how fair that argument is. But of course, he's a comedian. It doesn't have to be fair. But it's an interesting way in which to sort of that one's played out. I think if you do go across cultures.
Well, Oprah used to do a lot on this. I mean, yeah. She would do whole shows. She did a number of shows when I was a teenager in which she was talking to black audience about the culturally specific
right.
dimensions
yeah.
of corporal
yeah.
punishment. So it's a very real topic.
All right. So we have to switch topics here and because time is limited. I did say that this was the official special Ape, not Instagram Ape edition of the news. Slate.com, one of the many publications Mark Oppenheimer writes for, writes, you have to feel for David Slater. In 2011, the British photographer traveled to Indonesia to take pictures of the crested black macaque, a snouty primate with reddish, somewhat possessed-looking eyes. During the expedition, fortune struck when, in the words of the Telegraph, one of the animals came up to investigate his equipment, hijacked a camera, and took hundreds of selfies. Now, Slater is in a fight with the Wikimedia Foundation, which has posted his photo online. He got one, this ape got one picture of itself that is fabulous. I mean, it is just a fabulous.
I wish I had that good of a selfie
yeah,
of myself.
It is a fabulous picture. The Wikimedia Foundation has posted the photo online in a collection of public domain images and refuses to take it down. It argues that Slater doesn't own the picture's copyright because he didn't take the picture. The monkey did. And since the monkey can't own the rights, nobody does. Slater says that trip cost me about £2,000 for the monkey shot, not to mention the $5,000 of equipment I carry, the insurance, the computer stuff I use to process the images. Photography is an expensive profession that's being encroached upon. They're taking our livelihoods away. And now, of course, it's even worse. Monkeys can take your livelihood away. So I don't know whether we're at sort of a dawn of the planet of the ape selfies moment here, whether this is like although, I mean, the issue of copyright is really fascinating. And when Slate and some of the other publications that have covered this sort of looked at it, it sort of looked as though maybe Wikimedia is in better shape to make their case than David Slater is, that it might really be the case that if an ape grabs your camera and takes a selfie, it's just not yours anymore. But I don't know. Does anybody have a reaction to all this? James, you have to have a reaction.
Well, I was thinking that in this particular case, I mean, certainly the fact that the monkey the monkey seems self-aware. That's sort of, you know, like disturbing enough.
Smiling and everything.
It's
smiling.
Come on. Yes, it's like smiling. So I think we might need to get comments from the monkey. But the whole thing about it brings up this whole thing about what one of the legal arguments is that, well, the monkey is an animal and animals are property. And so, and therefore, you know, they can't hold a copyright. They can't actually be able to exert the right to control, and therefore, David Slater is saying that, oh well, I should get the right as a result, which I think is absurd. But I think that the monkey itself being property brings up a whole question about the status of. It's kind of like what we were talking about too with spanking children. I mean, children, the whole concept of children having independent rights as human beings and how animals are treated. I mean, it's kind of joking reference when you have a monkey taking a selfie, but it's kind of opened the door to.
So you're saying the monkey actually should. It's not that nobody owns the rights. The monkey owns the rights.
Absolutely.
Own the right,
yeah.
Right.
And the monkey has not relinquished those rights to Wikimedia yet.
Exactly.
And my favorite is that the monkey, which is arguably closer to a human being perhaps, you know, not a person. But a corporation is a person.
There you
in
are.
Some
exactly. It goes full circle. Yeah. Exactly.
And, there
and, then,
gonna, there
and
are...
then the fact that we don't spank the corporate
I spank
CEOs.
I spank apes. Yeah.
He had to go there.
Yes, someone was going to say
ape.
That. So now, see, that caused me to lose my train
Sorry.
Of thought. Oh, there are cases working their way through the court system, right? I think we are going to see one of the things that I would predict over the next decade is the sorting out of the rights of animals is going at a sort of Peter Singer level is going to happen more and more. And the whole there will be more and more case law that you could then in a future situation like this retrospectively look at and say, oh, well, actually monkeys do maybe have a little bit more standing. I think right now the monkey has no standing. Right. There's no way the monkey can.
National
can
Review will love that.
Yes,
the monkeys
absolutely.
Have standing.
Right.
I mean, look, so much of this does come back to power. I actually think this is very
exactly
similar, which
right.
is, and you know, my friend, the political philosopher Corey Robin, wrote a whole book that said that essentially the conservative impulse is about power.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
about money specifically. That if you really what all of the different conservative impulses have in common is a desire to locate power among the people who want power.
Right.
And that's how with the conservative response to labor, to organized labor, to animals, to children, to women's reproductive rights. That really what they have in common is trying to keep power in the hands of the people who have it.
Challenged.
And I think, you know, as a vegetarian, I think there's no question that applies to a general conservative impulse toward animal rights.
Yeah, I agree.
We'll stop there. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll endorse things. You'll stay with us, please. We'll be back after this.
Okay, I'll tell your joke on the air. How does it go? I don't get it. Why would a cheetah do that? Okay, that is pretty funny, but we'd lose our license. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Lily Tyson. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ethan Hawke. For show pages, articles, and selfies of the Faith Middleton Show staff with King Kong, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, show New Yorker writer Maria Konnikova on the 3-day work week. And now, back to Colin.
Just a couple of additions and amplifications. Yeah, Maria Konnikova will be the super guest on the Scramble on Monday. She'll pick three topics to talk about. We're pretty sure one of them will be the 3-day work week, which she's just written about, the idea that we would be more creative, productive, and happy if we worked 3 days for more hours and into our 70s. But we're doing other things the other 4 days. Also, Lily Tyson, our excellent intern, is having her last day here today. I think her birthday was also yesterday. We've had this group of interns this summer who I refer to as the Fab Five. They are it's kind of a nice, even distribution of talent and initiative. This has been an exciting intern class to work with. So now we'll be down to Fab Four, and I am sad about that. All right, time for endorsements. I've tried to leave plenty of time. So, Tracy Wu Fastenberg, you get to go first.
All right, I have to do the one that's related to work first.
Okay.
October 21st, we have Mark My Words coming, which is based around the musical Wicked. So we have Gregory Maguire, who wrote the book, Stephen Schwartz, who did the musical itself. They'll be on stage in conversation with Frank Rizzo. You can go to twainmarkmywords.com. And also, with my recent experiences, breaking my ankle at 6 months pregnant and then having the baby early and her being in the NICU, I know there's lots of arguments around healthcare and Obamacare and all of those things. And I think what gets obscured in that sometimes is are the folks that really provide that on the ground care. So I just want to say that you should go and appreciate your providers, the nurses over at the CCMC NICU, the folks at Hartford Hospital were wonderful to us. And so I just think that remembering that is a good thing.
Let's also endorse together this video that you sent over to all of us. At least you and I can endorse this together. It's kind of interesting. It's about a French supermarket chain, Intermarché, who got sort of interested in the whole question of all the fruits and vegetables that get thrown out.
The ugly fruits and vegetables.
Right. So they actually – you can see it. If you Google – Inglorious Fruits and Vegetables. You will probably be able to get that video pretty quickly. It's a campaign they started basically to get people to think differently about this and maybe price some of the ugly and less appetizing fruits and vegetables, less appetizing looking fruits and vegetables differently. And it's been this huge hit. So, and it really sort of does call to mind the amount of food that gets wasted. And it's just, it's a fascinating thing to watch. So, Inglorious Fruits and Vegetables, courtesy of the French supermarket chain Intermarché. All right, James?
I thought that was fantastic, too, so I'd co-endorse that as well. Just the big event coming up at Sony Studios starting next Friday, the 15th, I think, is Martin Scorsese has restored some of the masterpieces of Polish cinema. We have 16 of them that we'll be showing, one per day and on matinees, separate films. These are extraordinary films that are really amazing to the history of cinema, but also about Poland, about the talent of the filmmakers, absolutely stunning films, beautifully restored, and they have not been seen, most of them, for many years. These are restorations that are touring the country and not playing very many places. So we have 2 weeks of those films, really not to be missed. Quite a amazing occasion starting next Friday.
And having seen the Polish movie Ida there at your shop, that gets you even more excited about the potential. That's not one of the Scorsese ones, but it was great. I think you do say Ida. They say Ida.
Ida is Ida, the yeah. Yes. Although the publicity of the film kept saying Ida.
Ida. Which go see Ida.
I think they were trying to get us to think that they'd get the public to think it wasn't a foreign film. Maybe. I'm not sure.
All right, Mark. What have you got?
You want two or one?
You can do two.
Do two. All right. So the first is my eldest daughter went off to summer camp this summer. She went up to Camp Ramah in Palmer, Massachusetts, where they send home a letter that says not only is your child not allowed to bring electronics, but in the past parents have tried to sneak cell phones into their kids' bags, telling them don't tell anyone, it's just for an emergency. If you do that as a parent, we will – spank your child. No, I don't remember what, but the insistence with which they said this is a time for a child to be technology free was really, really admirable.
What if they see a monkey and the monkey wants to take a selfie and they don't have a camera?
Monkeys
have no
may
cell
take
phone.
Selfies, but not on Saturday when you don't use electronics at this camp. So that's the first one. And the second is the great essayist Ellen Willis, who was the first rock critic for the New Yorker. She also was a founder of Red Stockings, the radical feminist collective, and also just an essayist on all sorts of random odd things, totally unpredictable. Just when you think you knew what she would say, she would come back with something unconventional that would discomfort all of her friends. There's a new collection called The Essential Ellen Willis out from University of Minnesota Press. I've been reading these essays, and they're just the best things ever. And if you like the art of the personal essay or the political essay, you have to discover or rediscover this Ellen Willis collection.
All right. And tonight at Billings Forge, I will be performing for the third time in my life with the improv troupe CT Improv. I urge you to come. It's at 8 o'clock. It's a very cheap ticket. Do not bring your children, all right? Get a sitter for your children. Don't spank your children, but don't bring your children to this. I am going to use terrible language. I'm going to talk about things that you have not yet discussed with your children. So don't bring your children. I can't emphasize that enough because people often do show up at these wholesome CT Improv things with their children. I don't want to see children there. But it really – they are wonderful. I'm part of the joy of doing this. I do a series of monologues based on prompts from the audience or from whatever. And a lot of the fun is then seeing what the CT Improv troupe does with the monologue that I've done. So when Tracy was sending us the thing about Inglorious Fruits and Vegetables, that kind of triggered a trip over to Slate where there was an article about plums and William Carlos Williams' poem came up. And so the last thing I'm going to endorse, and I think I have maybe time to read, is A Late Aubade by Richard Wilbur. You could be sitting now in a carol turning some liver-spotted page or rising in an elevator cage towards ladies' apparel. You could be planting a raucous bed of salvia in rubber gloves or lunching through a screed of someone's loves with pity pitying head, or making some unhappy setter heel, or listening to a bleak lecture on Schoenberg's serial technique. Isn't this better? Think of all the time you are not wasting and would not care to waste. Such things, thank God, not being to your taste. Think what a lot of time, by woman's reckoning, you've saved, and so may spend on this, who had rather lie in bed and kiss than anything. It's almost noon, you say? If so, time flies, and I need not rehearse the rosebud's theme of centuries of verse. If you must go, wait for a while, then slip downstairs and bring us up some chilled white wine and some blue cheese and crackers and some fine ruddy-skinned pears. So have some ruddy-skinned pears this weekend and go to a nice movie at Trinity Cine Studio and then go to the Mark Twain House and read one of Mark Oppenheimer's ebooks. He just wrote one during the show. And thanks to all of you for being here today.
I'm Kyone Wolf. I have no idea what to say for the last word today. Do you have any ideas, Monkey? Monkey, this is a family radio show.